Proleith, writing in The Oldie, describes her encounter with skinny jabs. Lose weight with skinny jabs? Fat chance? I've spent nearly all my long life longing to lose a stone. I doubt there is a potion or regime I haven't tried. Remember limits? The little biscuits, each 100 calories? You ate 12 of them a day instead of everything else. Then there were the slimming drinks, Weight Watchers' unsatisfying ready meals, and some amazing pills called Nobis, which were rapidly banned. And all sorts of diets. The drinking man's diet, the bananas and milk diet, and a delicious one on which I lost no weight at all, the pineapple and lamb chop diet. I've twice been to starve farms. The first time was to the now defunct Shrubland Hall, when my son was 4 months old and I wanted to lose the post-baby fat. I went with my sister-in-law, and we had a little cottage in the grounds so that the other clients, patients, would not be bothered by a brawling baby. All we got by way of sustenance was lemon and hay tea, and at night it had a spoon of honey in it. It certainly worked, but it was hell, especially as we were feeding the baby soft-boiled eggs and toast soldiers. When he spat this out, it was all I could do not to gobble it up. Another time was to a now equally defunct health farm, Towerleys in Bristol, where I went for a week with my mama. I thought I'd kill three birds with one stone. I'd lose a stone, dutifully spend time with my mother, and get going writing a cookbook. That was hell too. Writing recipes for Coq au Vin and pavlova when you are starving is tough. And Towerleys was obsessed with colonic irrigation and mud baths. So why, when the skinny jabs had become all the rage, was I not at the head of the queue? My husband signed up and lost a stone and a half in a month. He loved it. He was never hungry, ate half the quantity he used to, stopped snacking completely, and pretty well gave up drinking. He said it increased his enjoyment of meals. He looks great, feels fit, and needs new trousers. But something Puritan in me would not let me do something so effortless, painless, and expensive. What's the matter with good old willpower? So I held out. That is, until I discovered that half the people I know, including my doctor, are happily stabbing themselves. I gave in. And can you believe it? I have not lost one single ounce in 7 weeks. 2 years ago, I did finally lose a stone after a determined calorie-counting diet, but I'd like to lose another, damn it. I certainly have no appetite. I'm certainly eating and drinking half what I was, and I am totally exhausted all the time. Desperate for a siesta in the afternoon and bed at 9:30. And I'm not one single imperial pound lighter. Only lighter by several hundred pounds sterling. P.S. I finally quit after 2 more weeks on the drug, and oh, the relief. To have some energy back, regain my appetite, and not feel below par all the time. Frankly, I'd rather be fat and happy.
There are far too many wonderful carols that have faded into obscurity, writes Richard Morrison in BBC Music. The little church choir in which I sang more than half a century ago had an unbreakable engagement every Christmas Eve. We would walk around the local cottage hospital singing carols. Some patients were clearly very ill, so the rules for us kids were nothing louder than mezzo piano. Don't stare and keep moving. If patients did want to talk, our genial vicar walked just behind us, fielding compliments, complaints, concerns, and any chockies on offer, as he put it. But there was one moment when we did stand still and sing strongly. The hospital had a long corridor connecting its two wings, and its echo was astonishing. Our harmonies, which sounded so weedy as we moved through the wards, suddenly acquired extraordinary richness, and by some acoustical alchemy, the result carried to the far corners of the hospital. It sounds like a swimming pool, I exclaimed, when I first encountered this magic corridor. In this corridor, we always performed the same carol, Angels from the Realms of Glory. Why? Because its refrain, with the single word Gloria, extended in a series of lush harmonic sequences, sounded absolutely fantastic in the acoustic. Years later, I learnt that the carol's author, a radical 19th century Scot called James Montgomery, never intended Gloria in Excelsis Deo to be the refrain. He had written, Come and Worship. Later editors clearly decided this phrase was far too lowbrow and substituted the Latin instead. But as an awestruck 9-year-old, it was the sound of the carol echoing down the corridor that fascinated me, not the words. These days, you don't hear Angels from the Realm so much. People prefer its zippier half-sister, Ding Dong Merrily on High. The sad thing is that Angels for the Realms isn't the only carol in danger of disappearing. One problem is that thousands of schools have turned their back on fine old carols, opting instead for seasonal pop songs or trite modern ditties. But even in churches with serious choral traditions, there has been, I think, a narrowing of the carol repertoire over my lifetime. Case in point, the Christmas morning services in my youth invariably opened with a rousing hymn called Christians Awake, Salute the Happy Morn. I love the story of how it was created as a poem titled Christmas Day for Dolly, written by a Manchester poet, John Byrom, as a gift for his teenage daughter, Dorothy. It was then set to music by a local organist, John Wainwright, who was apparently so pleased with his tune that on Christmas Eve 1750 he brought his entire choir round to Byrom's house to sing it to him. Yet today, I imagine, there is barely one church in 50 where Christians Awake is still sung. One cleric I questioned about this declared that the language was too complex for congregations today. But isn't one fascination of ancient carols their sometimes mystifying language and metaphors? How, for example, did three ships sail into Bethlehem, a landlocked city on top of a hill? What are we to make of the bizarre horticultural miracles in the Cherry Tree Carol? And on the subject of trees, why do so many medieval carols use the metaphor of the holly bush to mirror Christ's birth, life, and death? Were they borrowing ideas from pagan tree worship rituals, many centuries older than Christianity itself? These mysterious and beautiful carols should be pondered anew by each generation. Preserving them is as vital as preserving ancient buildings or paintings, and a lot cheaper. All we have to do is be a little more adventurous about what we sing every Christmas. Oh, little town of Bethlehem won't wither away if you give it a miss this year. But other wonderful carols are already slipping from obscurity to oblivion, and Christmas becomes that little bit blander with each disappearance.
Writing in The Guardian, Kate Lloyd asks, is it true that you should take vitamin C when you've got a cold? Vitamin C is important for your health in lots of ways, says Daniel M. Davis, the head of life sciences at Imperial College London. It's a strong antioxidant, helping protect cells from harmful, unstable compounds that arise from toxins and pollution. It helps the body absorb iron and is also used in the production of collagen. But the idea that taking high doses of vitamin C or drinking lots of orange juice will stop you catching a cold or help you recover faster is a myth. Davis explains that the popular belief in vitamin C's cold-fighting powers has persisted for more than 50 years, pretty much solely because of the evangelical view of one man, Linus Pauling. A double Nobel Prize winner, and one of the most influential chemists of the 20th century, Pauling made a major contribution to our understanding of vitamins. However, he exaggerated vitamin C's benefits. Pauling's 1970 book, Vitamin C and the Common Cold, became a bestseller, explains Davis, sparking such high demand that factories were built to keep up with supplement production. In truth, research shows that people who take vitamin C supplements are just as likely to catch a cold as those who don't. And while supplementation may slightly reduce symptoms' duration by about 8% in adults, the effect is modest. It's also difficult to interpret that data, said Davis, because people who regularly take high doses of vitamin C are often more health conscious in general. Instead, he recommends focusing on vitamin D if you want to fight off sickness. It's much more clearly established as important for immune health, he says. Vitamin D is available from exposure to sunlight between March and October, but the NHS suggests that during winter, people may want to take it as a supplement.
Helen Pilcher, writing in the BBC Wildlife magazine, answers the question, which animal has the best sense of hearing? One that has no obvious ears. The greater wax moth, which lays its eggs in honeybee hives around the globe, is said to have the best hearing of any animal on Earth. This little silvery grey moth hears using a pair of simple devices called tympanal organs. These are not ears as most people think of them, with fur and skin and flappy bits of cartilage. Instead, they are thin membranes stretched across air-filled chambers located on either side of the moth's thorax. The membranes vibrate in response to sound, sending signals along the auditory nerve to the brain where they are processed. Laboratory studies, which have recorded electrical activity from the auditory nerve, have shown that the moth can detect frequencies of up to 300 kilohertz. For context, humans can hear up to 20 kilohertz, dolphins up to 150 kilohertz, and bats up to around 210 kilohertz. The moth's impressive hearing range is thought to have evolved in response to pressure from its winged, fly-by-night predators, bats. Over time, the moths developed the ability to detect the high-frequency calls that bats make as they echolocate their prey. Their excellent hearing helps to prevent them from being eaten.
J.W., writing in the BBC History magazine, asks the question, how did the teddy bear get its name? Perhaps the question should be, would we have the beloved toy at all if a US president had enjoyed more luck on a hunting trip? Its origins stretch back to November 1902, when Theodore Roosevelt travelled to Mississippi to hunt black bear. After several days with no sign of his quarry, his guide decided to tie an ageing injured bear to a willow tree to make sure that the president could secure an easy kill. Roosevelt refused, however, insisting that it would not be sporting. The incident made its way to the newspapers and inspired political cartoonist Clifford Berryman at the Washington Post. He drew the president, who had a well-deserved reputation as an avid hunter, with his back to the defenceless, trussed-up bear. In turn, Berryman's cartoon inspired Morris and Rose Mictum, owners of a candy store in New York, who made a stuffed toy bear to display in their shop window. They dedicated it to the president and even received permission to christen their creation after him, using his nickname Teddy. Oddly enough, another toy bear was being developed independently at the same time by German company Steiff. Richard Steiff designed his bear with movable joints and sold 3,000 to an American businessman just in time to take advantage of the Roosevelt story.
So that brings us to the end of this edition of The Talking Newspaper. My thanks to all involved in this week's production. Don't forget, we want to hear from you with any comments you have about the recordings. Do call us on Darlington 465 101. If there is no one in the office to answer your call, leave a message and we will get back to you. or you can email us at dtnewspaper@outlook.com. Until next time, look after yourselves. From me, Pat Walker, and all the team, goodbye.